National Council of Jewish Women, oral interview with Lenny Littman on January the 21st, 1987. Okay, we're going to pick up where we stopped last time, and I'd like, if I may, Mr. Littman, to go back to the Murphy's Music Bar period in your life. That was a time when a lot of jazz greats played in your club. And I thought you might like to talk a bit about some of those personalities that you remember best.
The most famous one of them all was Art Tatum. Art Tatum was considered the greatest jazz piano player that ever lived. I found him at 52nd Street, and it took me 2 months to bring him to Pittsburgh. He was a blind man, and he came on, and he played Bull Hubs. They lined up to see him, and the interesting part of it, there's a piano player in Pittsburgh named Johnny Costa, who played him and tried to use his technique. He was supposed to have the finest hands, the quickest hands. So Johnny Costa went up and played Carry Dances, which was one of Tatum's songs. And Art was sitting there with me while Costa was playing. And he said, that's very nice of you, Linda, to play one of my records. And Costa was told that. And to this day, that's his favorite story, because he was compared with his idol. And through the two Murphys, Art Tatum didn't get too many jobs because he had the problem. He was blind. He carried his brother with him, and he liked to sit down in the city so he wouldn't have to move around too much. So two or three years later, I took him on a short tour playing buildings in Johnstown and Altoona and Syria Mosque in concert. And at that time, he was asked by a woman whose son was blind if he would listen to her. And Art always would do anything like that. He would listen, and he asked the boy after he was finished playing, he says, did you ever think of playing another instrument? And the mother was start crying, and he said, I'll listen to him again. So she came 3 weeks later, some other city. And it was at that time that Tatum said, you know, Lynn, it's tough to be a nigger. It's tough to be a nigger without talent. Just imagine being a blind nigger without talent. And he was very philosophical about that. He knew that he was he was afraid to have his other eye, his right eye was, he could see shadows. And he was afraid to have it operated on. And he was had serious diabetes. And he was afraid the eye would go bad because of diabetes. And he had one of his legs cut off. And
was this fairly late in his career? Or can you think of it around the time, around the date? Yes.
It was started in about 46, 45. I had to get him, go to New York and find him. I had to go to his agent, and I had to raise the money, arrange for the money. The money wasn't much. It was only $250 a week. But he liked to play Pittsburgh, and he had a lot of friends up on the hill. And he used to play the old Washington Club. And he was a man.
The Washington Club.
Yeah, that was on the hill. He working, he was working the COPA, and Nat King Cole was working Syrian Mosque, and Earl Garner was at Carnival Lounge. I'm jumping on records now, I'm going back to it. And they went up to the Washington Club, and they were playing piano. All three of them. And it's like two pianos, twin pianos, and one would get up and the other would go. And this lasted for 6 hours.
What a night.
Yeah. Unbeknownst to a lot of people, Nat King Cole was a very, very good pianist. And they played everything in all kind of jazz arrangements. Until about 4 to 7, piano player named Cotton Lance, who was just an ordinary player, he was able to accompany him by himself. And that was the extent of his talent. So these three were alternating and drinking and having a lot of fun. Cotton Lance stopped them and he said, "Hey, let me get in on this. Let somebody play a can." And I said, grabbed a hold of his brother's arm, and he got up and went on. And Cotton Lance finished the session. Going back to Merkers, he was one of many, but he was the greatest. I mean, it's like there's a Statue of Liberty and then a statue around the country. Nobody equaled him. He was in a lot of movies. Tommy Dorsey said in one of his movies, The Fabulous Dorsey, he said, let's go over, we're in Toledo now. He was from Toledo. And let's hear some real jazz. Art Tatum was playing that. Most of his records were recorded by this Norman Granz you talked about the other day. And he played at the COPA, played at the Merkers Music Bar, he played the Syrian Mosque, and he was in a class of his own. There was actually nobody could even come close to him.
Who else did you really respect or admire of the players who came to him?
Well, there was George Shearing. He played there for the first time and then came back. And then he played the COPA, and the first time he came in the COPA, he says, I didn't see any of my people at ringside. He was a very great member of the NAACP. He was strong for civil rights long before it was recognized.
This would have been in the 40s? He started in your club?
Well, he played, for me, he played at the Merkers, the COPA, Making Music Hall, Syrian Mosque, Mr. Shearing.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he was in the Newport Jazz Festival, which was at Syrian Mosque, and he came in late. He missed his plane, and I had a refund on the money, because the Newport Jazz Festival, if Shearing wasn't there, they didn't have a whole show, so collect the stuff and we'll get back the money. We had 4,000 at the show, but we funded 7,000. But then he played Wal Harper's 3 or 4 times. He plays Pittsburgh Jazz Festival all the time.
But he started with you.
Well, it was one of his, it was getting $200 a week. Now, well, then he started with me. He had to start somewhere because he was a very skillful pianist. But when he came alone and couldn't afford to have anybody to. He had a wife. But somehow or other he was able to manage. She must have put him on a plane and he had made arrangements to come to the club. And then when I sold Merkers, he played there again for Colonel Harry Fox. But he used to sit right on Market Square every day and read his Braille books. And he was still a fine gentleman, and most of his work now is being done with Mel Torme. And Mel Torme and Frank are friends, and they're doing that together. Other ones that were, of course, Earl Garner was at Mercer's, Mary Lou Williams. There's a thing in that period called Boogie Woogie, and two of its greatest exponents was Meat Lux Lewis and Pete Johnson, and they were regulars. A pianist named Joe Sullivan, and Mary Lou Williams. Mary Lou Williams was from Pittsburgh.
Was Pittsburgh a good jazz and music?
Generally considered the best. For some reason, because Earl Father Hines and Billy Eckstein hired the best musicians. Billy Eckstein had in his band Sarah Vaughan, Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, and people like that. And preceding him was Earl Father Hines. Earl Father Hines, he never played except at the Encore. And, he was the one who hired Billy Eckstein, or brought Billy Eckstein to the fore. See, Billy Eckstein was a great musician. It wasn't until he had that wonderful voice. And he formed his own band. He had probably the best jazz band in the history of music.
Did you know him as a Pittsburgh boy early on?
Well, I knew him. If you don't remember, Billy Eckstein was the star when the war was over. He had his own band. And when I came back, I knew of him, and I met him, and I tried to book him, but his price at that time was $1,200, and I didn't think he was worth that.
This was in the mid-40s, probably.
This is a 48, 49. Mm-hmm. See, at that time, it seemed that if you were black, you didn't command the high salary that a white guy did, for some reason. So finally, learned why it was. Like a Pearl Bailey, you could get for $7.50 a week. But if you had one of June Christie, it cost you $12.50 a week. If you want a Sarah Vaughan, it would be $500 a week or $7.50 a week. And if you wanted Kitty Callan, Patty Page was very cheap. She was just beginning. But these established people, the Blackwood singer, even though they were as much as you wanted, their price was lower, and I jumped right on the bandwagon. Ella Fitzgerald, for instance, was $1,250, and Frankie Lane was $1,500. I paid Matt Cole $3,000, but he was a big established star, and he was the highest I ever paid anybody at the Cooper. He was very hot with Nature Boy.
Some people then that you had used at Merkers went with you to the Cooper.
They didn't go with me. They were established stars, mm-hmm. and they would go all over the country. And if I couldn't play them at Merkers, see, I had already sold Merkers when I bought the Cooper. Colonel Fox had taken over the Cooper. So I had the Carnival. And that's where Nancy Wilson played. And then all the rock and rollers, these were all black. And since they couldn't get work in white places, they would play the rock and roll and some of the best names in it, if I forget.
Did white Pittsburgh audiences seem to you to be receptive to black entertainers? This, again, was before the civil rights
I never knew, except when it hit me, like the time I was with Earl Barnard, I went serenade. And the time when George Shearing walked in and said, "I don't see any of my people there, or any of my brothers," he said. And one time the NAACP came down, and I had Sarah Vaughan, and they wanted to know why colored people weren't allowed in. And I said, I didn't know that they weren't allowed in, but I'll see if it doesn't happen again. To me, it was a very, very minor issue, because I wasn't aware of it, and I asked the head waiter, and I said, I got some complaints about Negroes coming in. He said, well, he says, you know, I dressed up this, you have to dress up the floor and the people, and so how those people are in the old days, you know, they didn't like to see me sitting back in front of colored people. And he says, I like to dress up the floor by putting the good rich people and look good and letting the pretty women ringside, and it makes it look right. And I said, well, doesn't black people and colored people never look nice? He says, well, then they're still old fashioned. And I said, well, now on, put the people down when they come in, wherever they are, just put them down. Don't worry about the problem. And there was a Dr. Baltimore. He was a doctor, and he liked to come in. He liked jazz. He liked to see the artists. But he would come in, and so Gus Harris put him ringside. He was all by himself, which is, you know, that you should do that. That's when he would give up a table for one. He said, I don't want to sit there. I want to sit in the back. And Gus says, why? He said, I like to sit in the back. He said, you mean you're not used to it? He says, no, I never get used to that. He brought that up to me just a couple of months ago when we were at some sort of party. But the black situation did not exist. In fact, of the top 10 people who did the most grosses, the Cope, I would say, were black. That would include Johnny Mathis, Matt Cole, Pearl Bailey, I guess. Then the rest of them didn't do it. But Diane Carroll, she wasn't big when she was there. The big ones was Andre Philippe, Al Morgan, Frankie Lane.
Which of those people who worked the Cove when you were there remain in your memory as really outstanding among the many entertainers?
Well, Andre Philippe is still a friend. I hear from him every now and then. Steve Lawrence is a friend. Don Rickles. Vic DeMone. I don't call them friends. You don't call show people friends. Show people like Marty Allen, let's get started there. We were friends because we were both from Squirrel Hill. And he was there to be, I was there at the beginning. And Roz, my wife, and his mother, Elsie, were very good friends. But the show people reach certain stages where they have to associate with their peers. Sometimes they go up, sometimes they go down. If you like these, Emily, Jewish, Aaron does...
Sure, whatever you'd like to tell us.
When you deal with show people, it's, what have you done for me lately? Where are you? See, they go so fast. They come in, they're kids. They're 18, 19 years old. Some of them you form a strong relationship with, but then when they get to be making a lot of money, one real good example, because all the way up and down, is Harry Belafonte. He came in doing an impression of Billy Eckstein. It was terrible. And I took him aside and I said, I said, son, don't you think you ought to get into another line of work? He said, what can I do? And I said, well, he says, could I be a cook? I said, I don't think so. We have a contract with the union in black and white. He said, well, what could I do? I said, well, first you quit faking that Billy Eckstein voice and try to be natural. And I said, tell you what I'll do, Harry. You're making $150 a week. I'll pay you for the week, but I'm going to put someone else in to finish out the week. It just so happened that a girl who was who had just played the lead in Variety in the movies was in town. When I was handling some of her business, it was Mary Hatchett, but she finished that to me. Now, this was Harry was making $150 a week. Anything I wanted, anything he wanted, was very, very close. And about 2 years later, he found Calypso and became a sensation. He had gone, and actually had gone to work in as a short order cook and learned the food business. And he was going to open a restaurant. But when he found out that he could do these Calypsos and his record became very big, he was presented by another promoter at Sirius Mosque. And the following year, when he was rabbi again, I played him at the Civic Arena in the round. And the next year, I played him in the full building. And he sold out both times. But the second time, he was ready to cancel because his program, it's called the book. There's a souvenir book that goes with all shows. And they wanted too much commission off him, and Harry stood behind him and said that if he doesn't sell his books, I don't know. In the meantime, he had like 60 nurses, 60 nuns. And he was very fond of this certain order, and he had them as his guests all the time. So he played there for me for, I think, three years in a row. And then the next time was at Heinz Hall. Now, this was when the time I was ready to quit promoting. And I was then working for the press, and I thought it was a conflict of interest. And he did well, but he was missing on one show. I think it was a Thursday, so a week's stand. And he said, do anything, paper it. I said, well, Christ, you never let me paper it before. He said, well, I'm doing it now, and I'll not paper it. And he got pretty solid. I said, you want to paper it yourself. I've been taking care of your nuns all these years. And I'll take care of anybody you want. But just papering, that's just give people a free ticket, is no good. I said, when you paper, you got to make some sense to it. You're doing some good for some people. Let's bring in some veterans. Let's bring in somebody that will appreciate the show. He said, well, I don't care how you do it. Just do it. And it was pretty curt. And the next year, he decided he was going to go with the villain. And he played the villain. And it was very cool. And I went down to Wish and Lock in the show. And he didn't play to Pittsburgh again until he went to Syrian Mosque in to Stanley, it was a complete flop. Now this is where his argument has been that the promoter doesn't want to work to promote his concert anymore. He wants to get an act, put one ad in the paper, and sell it out the next day, which Harry used to do all the time. But then his reference to the promoters was that they weren't working, so that's why he wasn't doing any more concerts. That's why he didn't do concerts anymore.
You're saying that's pretty typical of the rise and fall of...
Yeah, you, a good example, the same thing guy had me from Pittsburgh, Bobby Vinton. Bobby Vinton was a very, very big nightclub guy. He was very good. He was a twin coaches when he asked me if I would promote him. And I said, you're not a concert act, but I said, you're great for the nightclub, but you know, when you start charging people $10, you got to get more of a nightclub now. And so he recorded the Melody of Love. And he went to Poland and he made this record. And he booked himself in the Heinz Hall for 1 week. No, 1 night. And he said, how would you? And he said, I'm going myself. Pay it all myself. So he went in and he there was a manager there, Emmanuel Levine, who saw what was happening. He was selling out as soon as the box office opened. And he worked him around 13 weeks. And every time he sees me, he says, see, you said I couldn't be a concert actor. Say, I said, well, all right, Melody and Love. But that, that always happens in the Johnny Mathis case, where he started off at $200 and nobody knew him. I always would insist on options as many as I could get. And options didn't cost you anything. Whenever they were selling you an act, you would they wouldn't know any more about it than you did. If you knew, and if this jockey would tell you that somebody's good, he would say, all right, give me five options, $200 option. And they would give them to you because they wanted to expose the acts. And once they get the acts, you would call the agent to follow this pattern. The agent would be assigned a new act in the office.
What about some of the Jewish entertainers? Really impressed you one way or another?
Well, the Jewish entertainers, let's take for instance Steve Lawrence. Steve Lawrence was one of these acts that came in at $200 because he had a record and he had five options. And he was playing a week and he came up to me and he says, can I take tomorrow off? I says, why? He says, well, I gotta go to New York and sing Kol Nidre. I said, why? He said, well, you know, it's Yom Kippur, you're a Jew, aren't you? I said, yeah, I am. You? And he said, well, yes, I am. He said, but my father's a cantor. And I said, well, you can't go. There's a shulam out there right up on the hill. You can go there and you can sing there. I said, I have nobody to take your place. It's the Yom Kippur week. And he said, well, I forgot to tell you, when I came in here, I was 16 years old and I saw a cop out there. And not a lot of, I said, okay, go in there. But even though I had five options on him, I didn't pick up any of them because he didn't hit hard for many years. But I did play his wife all the time. She was very good. She was a very consistent attraction. That's Evie Gourmet. This other Jewish incident was a Canadian kid named Jackie Kahane. He had come into the United States, through Canada, and he originally came from Poland. But he stayed in Canada and he became a big favorite. And he came into the Copa as one of the comedy team of three. They broke up shortly thereafter, and then he came and played a single. He would open the show, and he was in there all the time. Anytime I needed a comedian, I used Jackie Kahane. So I was saying Yorkside for my father, and I told him about it. Some distant past, I had to go out to the show. He said, "Looks, you want me to go along?" He says, "I haven't said nothing yet." And I didn't know he was Jewish. So we went out there, and Nefer started. He said, "Who's davening?" I said, "The Shamus." He said, "Well, maybe I'll give him a break." And so he went up, and he led the davening, and he did it. And it was perfect. Three people went real fast and real good. And every time that he came, as he got bigger, he would come up and he would go to the show.